corruption can take a variety of forms, but we will discuss only a few of them here. A prominent politician was confidently looking forward to re-election and many more years with his snout comfortably buried in the public trough. Although his electorate recognised him as incompetent, many would smile and shake his hand in anticipation of telling their workmates and families of their conversation with the local politician. One woman decided that she had had enough of this type of flattery. She attended every function at which the Member of Parliament appeared and asked questions which he found difficult to answer. She also took every opportunity to remind his constituents that he had voted in Parliament contrary to his election promises. She reminded them of his incompetence, deceit, misrepresentation and his party's subservience, especially when this was not in the best interests of his own electorate. Not surprisingly, the life of this Member of Parliament became a misery. He was not accustomed to being challenged in this way. The end result was his resignation from Parliament. Of course, this would not have happened if this woman had not been capable, intelligent and just in her assessment and dealings with the local member. In essence, that electorate agreed with all that she had said, but had been cajoled into betraying its own self-interest until she broke the spell. There are other examples of moral persuasion being used in the most unusual way. During the Depression, a provincial city, because of its climate, felt that health needs could no longer be ignored and sewerage had to be installed. The city mayor refused to consider this because he said it was financially impossible. The citizens were not prepared to accept this. As part of their political activity, they gathered hundreds of bedpans and sanitary cans and arranged them in a mini mountain in the main street. A few suitable captions made their point of view known. At one point, a stray dog made an appropriate contribution to these exhibits and was caught in the act by the photographer of the local newspaper. It was one of those photographs that only come along once in a lifetime. That, of course, put considerable pressure on the mayor, but nevertheless, he was quite implacable. Sewerage in that city would not be considered. During the course of a few weeks, that position was completely reversed. He was induced to discover that it was financially possible to install sewerage. This conversion was arranged in the most unusual fashion. Whenever the Lord Mayor opened his diary, he would discover a photograph of the little dog and the bedpans. Whenever he ate a meal at the local restaurant, behold, under the plate was the photograph. Whenever he parked his car, he would return to find that photograph on the windscreen. When he went to his office, there on his desk was yet another photograph. After several weeks, the mayor was convinced, quite rightly, that the whole city was laughing at his predicament. This particular technique was brutal, but it was completely successful. Instances like these show that human initiative is the one thing that power mechanisms cannot withstand if applied with justice, humour and commitment. Thus far, we have not discussed tactics. This, I think, has been correct because tactics have very much to do with personal initiative and a local specific situation. The overall strategic considerations ought first to be understood. Yes, tactics are important and can be fun, and over a period you will gain experience as to what works and what doesn't. Defeat is always valuable in these situations because it shows what not to do. It helps us to be more effective in our efforts. There are many stories of what has been done at a tactical level. I'll just mention one. In an industrial matter, there was concern that a particular leader would not properly consider a certain proposal, nor answer questions about it. It was decided that since he was visiting the district, his neglect of the issue would be made apparent to those attending his meeting. There were about 250 people present. At a preliminary meeting, it was decided that each of the nine people involved would ask him a question relevant to this particular topic. They were well equipped with a selection of questions that could be asked so that the matter could be raised again and again. By dispersing themselves throughout the hall, they were able to dominate question time. Although the industry leader evaded the first question, he found himself being repeatedly brought back to the subject. In exasperation, he finally had to reveal something of his attitude towards the issue. Occasionally, a situation occurs which is sufficiently similar to offer the opportunity to reapply the tactic. Someone will observe that the real answer is to discover representatives who are moral and upright. This is sound enough as far as it goes. However, it is worth remembering that even when Jesus Christ chose the 12 disciples, one of them was a traitor. Judas Iscariot was not, in some respects perhaps, as bad as many of our political representatives, because he did, upon the realization of his betrayal, at least have sufficient remorse to hang himself. This has not been a characteristic of treacherous political representatives. Of course, we must try to choose representatives who are genuinely service motivated. However, we must go further than that and look to methods and mechanisms, checks and balances, and sanctions to ensure proper representation, one with the will of the electorate as the master and the political representative as the servant. For this reason, we are bringing three such mechanisms before you for consideration. The first of these mechanisms might be called the jack-up. This term, jack-up, derives from the observation that even a donkey has sanctions. If a donkey imposes sanctions by refusing to pull the cart, no measure of whipping him will change his mind. The first known application of the jack-up principle to human affairs came during the First World War. Australian troops had been ordered to disband their depleted units and combine with the English, something Australian soldiers just would not do. They did not strike. They maintained arms in the face of the enemy. They obeyed all orders except this one. It became known as the Great Jack-up. For most citizens, the first step towards the jack-up is reached when they decide they will not cast a formal vote for any candidate unless an acceptable candidate is available. This situation periodically arises where, especially in two-party contests, neither candidate is suitable to represent the citizen. In this situation, a formal vote is irresponsible. There has to be some acceptance of imperfections in all candidates, otherwise we would never vote for anybody. However, if we are prepared to vote no matter how meaningless, false, or dangerous the choice, we will ultimately find ourselves sanctioning our own demise and enslavement. The jack-up is, of course, a very negative mechanism. But change is unlikely unless people have at some point in their lives arrived at a situation of jack-up. In 1987, an unusual campaign was run in the Southern Queensland federal electorate of Rankin. Several people had decided that they were sick of voting for alternatives which didn't really deliver what they wanted from government, and that therefore they would jack-up. Of course, they could have nominated their own candidate, but none of them felt suitable for candidacy. Nor did they see any reason why the electorate should see them as better candidates than the others. Therefore, they offered a new approach. They approached voters where they could with a voter's pledge, in which they asked the citizen not to vote for any candidate unless certain commitments were made. The voter's pledge read, "I, Bill Smith, of whatever my address is, solemnly pledge not to give my first preference vote to any candidate at the federal election to choose a member for Rankin in the House of Representatives, to be held on the 11th July 1987, unless a suitable candidate for whom I would be prepared to vote gives a firm undertaking, in the form of a written contract, to use his vote in Parliament to achieve a specific result. These results are, 1. That as the electoral representative in the seat of Rankin, he or she will, during the first term in Parliament, move a private member's bill and will vote for such a bill, which would allow a referendum to be held at the request of any two states or 25 local government councils or 150,000 voters to either veto or repeal any legislation with which the Australian people disagree, or amend the Commonwealth Constitution in accordance with the will of the Australian people." They might have asked for any other result which they deemed to be desirable, but this group of people thought that in their case, unless something like this was achieved, then it was not worthwhile using their vote simply to prop up and to sanction their own state of powerlessness. This jack-up group did not have the resources to approach all electors to establish that a majority understood and wanted citizens-initiated referenda. However, the result they sought was a democratic one, in that, if achieved, all electors would thereafter be consulted. The contract they placed before all of the candidates set out the reasons they had taken this action. They not only sought the commitment of a candidate to CIR, but also to his liability by way of liquidated damages to the extent of $2,000 in the case of default. One of the major party's candidates, feeling that he had to attempt something out of the ordinary to win, was seriously tempted to sign. However, he ultimately declared that he could not sign the contract because he believed that it would compel him to vote against his party on at least several occasions every year. Several hundred people did commit themselves to this line of activity. Nevertheless, the sitting member retained his seat. To show that they were serious, many of the pledged electors manned polling booths at which they said to electors, "Don't vote, none of them are any good." As a mechanism to expose the fact that no candidate is prepared to give firm commitments to policy the electors want, this technique has merit. Even if a lot of people don't pledge themselves, it is clear to the electorate that no candidates are prepared to commit themselves to a particular policy. The concept of seeking a legally binding commitment from candidates has a lot of merit, which is easily recognised where a jack-up campaign is run. There are certain legal difficulties which may or may not be overcome in order to enable electors to develop a contractual arrangement with candidates. However, the validity and usefulness of contract law is well recognised in other areas of life, and few electors will deny that its application in politics could achieve the required results. Any candidate who is genuinely committed to performing a particular service or to furthering a particular policy will find it pays dividends to give legally binding and enforceable undertakings to any voters who choose to enter into a contract with him. Whatever the ultimate legal enforceability of such a contract, it can threaten a defaulting representative with very considerable legal costs. The mechanism will make it extremely clear to all voters that the representative did morally misrepresent his electorate, even if ultimately the contract proved to be unenforceable. All parties to a contract other than the representatives of the people are bound by the terms of that contract. Why can't politicians choose to commit themselves in such a manner in order to demonstrate that they are sincere? Why should the citizens be denied any form of redress when they are blatantly misrepresented and betrayed? Of course, this mechanism could not be used for more than an occasional extremely important issue. Could CIR be such an issue? In democracies where the population is deeply committed to freedom, especially in times when freedom seems to be diminishing, mechanisms such as the jack-up will be devised and promoted with increasing experimentation and perhaps considerable results. Had it not been for the rather unorthodox approach of the Swiss in the 1800s, then the concept of citizens having a direct say in legislation and the Constitution would never have been thought possible in the rest of the Western world. It may be that when we really have had enough, when we really have jacked up, then the jack-up mechanism will be the first and foremost cutting edge, inducing candidates to more honestly commit themselves in genuine service. A second mechanism that may be employed in encouraging a service approach by our representatives might be called the Electors Association. This might in fact be a ratepayers' association at local level, or even a shareholders' association formed to compel shareholders' policy on company directors. The basic approach with electors' associations is to approach electors in order to ascertain their policy in respect to issues and to convey this to the representative. On the other hand, the association seeks out the point of view and voting record of the representative and makes that known to the electors. Where the electors' association is motivated from genuine service and not from any attempt to misrepresent either representatives or electors, it can materially advance good representation in several ways. Firstly, in the absence of a service group of this type, very few electors are aware of a representative's voting pattern in Parliament or elsewhere, especially when that representative is in the habit of voting against the majority will of his electors. The representative is certainly not motivated to make this clearly and widely known. On the other hand, where electors do not fulfil their responsibility by advising their representatives of their will, then clearly the representative may use this position to exercise power in any way he chooses without censure. The first essential for this type of association is to ensure that a mechanism exists whereby the majority will of the electors can be ascertained and conveyed to the representative, and thereafter to ensure that the member, no matter what he does, has to take responsibility for his actions. Various techniques are used to ascertain the elector's will. Sometimes, where there is one main newspaper in an electorate, an advertisement with the ballot paper has been used. Letterboxing or door knocking may be used to ascertain views on a number of issues. Every Member of Parliament receives many thousands of dollars annually in what is called an electoral allowance to enable this to be done. However, by avoiding this responsibility, the Member of Parliament gets to keep the thousands of dollars as part of his income. He also retains the right to vote in his own best interest, which normally means in his party's interest, as it is his party which has endorsed him. The cost of properly running such an electors' association is considerable. At times when an issue is particularly controversial, sufficient money can be raised from businessmen and others who wish to support the issue. Electors' associations usually operate with a regular membership fee supplemented by donations to enable a newsletter to be printed addressing as many issues as seem to be important and inviting electors to state their chief concerns. Another important function of electors' associations has often been to hold Meet the Candidates nights. These meetings are normally organised by formally inviting all of the candidates for a forthcoming election to a public meeting which is widely advertised to voters. Often, some candidates will seek to avoid the potential embarrassment of electors asking them questions in front of a large audience and will deliberately stay away. For every candidate who absents himself, there is a large vacant chair with his name printed across the back of it and with a suitable comment such as, "He couldn't be bothered," or "The party will look after me," or whatever is appropriate. These nights usually get coverage in the local media, and a photograph of the candidates present, with the vacant chairs properly labelled, normally ensures a better attendance of candidates at future Meet the Candidates nights. Generally, a few set questions are asked of the candidates. It is best not to invite the candidates to make speeches. It takes a very authoritative chairman to shut a politician up once he has begun. The whole emphasis of the evening is to question candidates as to their attitudes to various issues and the concept of service itself. Generally, the set questions include such questions as, "Since you have applied for this position, can it be taken that you're satisfied with the salary, and can you give a guarantee that you'll not vote for a salary increase?" And, "To whom do you owe your first loyalty, to the electorate or to the party?" Another good question is, "Do you believe that the electorate should have the ultimate say on questions that it believes are particularly important?" If the answer is yes, "Do you believe that where the electorate gives a clear indication of the policy it wants on an issue, that the electors' will should be binding upon a representative?" If they again answer in the affirmative, they can be asked whether they will give an undertaking to move a private member's bill and to vote for such a bill to enable citizens-initiated referendums to be constitutionally established. An effective medium for communication with electors is the most critical imperative in running such an association. Most of the effort required is in developing relationships with existing media or creating new and independent ways of contacting the electors. It is a matter of constantly attempting to ensure that the electoral will prevails. In the end, trying to learn about mechanisms for maintaining and expanding freedom can only be achieved by doing. One cannot grow strong by watching other people eat up their porridge. The form that is eventually successful and is adopted by the electorate to curb the growing dictatorial power of the party machines is very likely to take a somewhat different shape from mechanisms discussed here. So be it. The principles and objectives will remain, though techniques, approaches and mechanisms will be and should be as flexible as possible. With the mechanisms of freedom allowing, as they must, the maximum involvement by the largest number of participants possible, the process of learning by doing is inevitably accompanied by many mistakes. Nevertheless, with persistence, goodwill and commitment, even large groups of people can learn, albeit slowly. No idea has ever been carried in human affairs without an associated human movement. No movement has ever prevailed, however potentially popular its objective, without a small, well-trained, fully committed core of service-motivated supporters. It is the hope of this school that increasing numbers of individuals can develop their own freedom through service, can discover others who are similarly motivated, and who can, no matter what mistakes are made, develop a movement for freedom.